I ended up losing a lot of money in my 20s. I supported a family investment and everything went really badly.
Stacey Morrison is a broadcasting powerhouse with over three decades of experience. From her early days on What Now and My Time to her current work on radio, Stacey's warm personality and versatility have cemented her as a Kiwi media icon. Fluent in te reo Māori, she passionately advocates for the language and culture, promoting it through her work and co-authoring books to help others.
How have they shaped your view on money?
I got hand-me-downs or the neighbours giving us clothes. I found that really embarrassing and I internalised it about money and worry and scarcity. And I remember my parents' working life and their, I guess, a bit of a window into their stress.
You're a massive advocate, teacher of te reo Māori.
It's funny, I heard someone said to me, they were saying how you and Scotty aren't even native speakers. Sherlock. You know, when you are kind of locked out of your language, feel locked out of your culture, this is so many emotional, spiritual, intellectual aspects to that reclamation. You can't turn up and just go, wow, I just happen to be amazing at this the next day. And if you're a perfectionist, it's hard. Kia kaha koe. Don't give up because cost of giving up is a lot. It's awful because we didn't choose this situation, but the power is in choosing what we do now.
This is the Fresh Money Podcast.
74% of Pasifika, 56% of Māori feel unconfident or unsure when making financial decisions. This podcast is all about opening up the conversation of money and to help everyone get better at it. So if you can please like and subscribe, it's our promise to interview more people who can help and inspire you to become better with money. Please note that this podcast does not constitute financial advice. If you are needing financial advice, please consult a professional or get in touch and we can point you in the right direction. Tala Flava, I'm Willie Liotta, and welcome to the Fresh Money Podcast. This is the show where we talk about all things money, from personal finance, business, to investment. If it involves money, we'll be talking about it. And today, I'm just extremely stoked to have Stacey Morrison on the show. Stacey, tēnā koe.
Kia ora.
Welcome. Thank you so much for your time and coming on the show.
Tēnā koe. Thank you for asking me. I think I'll see what the questions are like.
Sweet. But yeah, love to start off by, for those who've been living under a rock and don't know who you are, if you could introduce yourself and what you do.
Ko Stacey Morrison tōku ingoa. My name is Stacey Morrison, inaene now, these days, used to be Stacey Daniels, and I am a broadcaster in radio and TV sometimes and an author, and I love your product placement, thank you. Yes. One of our books, My First Words About Tikanga Māori, they're mostly focused on te reo Māori and helping people learn and engage, and especially tamariki has been one of our focuses to return te reo Māori as te reo ukaipō, a language of the home and a mother language. Yeah. So awesome. That's some of my mahi, and I'm a mama of three and married to my husband Scotty for 17 years.
Mean. And what do you do now?
Well, I've just come from my radio show at Flavour.
Cool.
The breakfast shift with Azura and Charlie. So that's kind of my day job.
Yep.
And then I also do consultancy, like a cultural consultancy for TV shows and maybe films. I've worked on a few of those. And sometimes as a reo consultant, I'm a qualified translator and interpreter now.
Yep.
And so I do quite a few different things.
Yeah, amazing.
So I'm a contractor as well as my day gig and my main gig is at Flavour, so that's based at NZME.
How long have you been with Flavour and in broadcasting in general?
Well, I've been at NZME coming up 20 years this year, but that was when Flavour first started in 2004.
Okay.
Then I went to a couple of other brands, they call them, as in Classic Hits, The Hits, and then back to Flavour in the end. But before that, I'd been at MyFM, so that would have been, I think, 96. Rob Dakati will probably correct me on that one.
Yep.
But, yeah, I actually started in TV when I was at high school, Aranui High School in Christchurch. That's a really long time ago.
Yeah, mate.
But it blows my mind how many people remember that I was ever on What Now or on, you know, youth shows. Yeah, my time. That blows my mind, and I guess those were the days that we didn't have as many choices in terms of content. So sure. we had to make an appointment to be in front of the TV yes. on a Saturday morning. Yes. And so then it kind of imprints in people's minds, I've realised now.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's pretty, it's kind of a privilege. It's pretty kind when people remember that. And it's funny too, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I see for them, their minds blowing a little bit. They go, this is so weird. like you kind of still exist. yeah.
That's awesome. I'll come back to that. Whereabouts did you grow up?
I grew up in Christchurch. And I'm Ngaitahu and Te Arawa, but Ngaitahu is our iwi, particularly from the area around Akaroa, Little River.
Yes.
And then on my kuia side, we're from Roturua. And I'm not closely related to my husband, but we are of the same iwi. yeah,
I'm Samoan, so I know what you're talking about.
Yes, you've got to do some double checks. Yeah. And my mum's whānau, my nana and granddad came out from England in the 50s. Wow. Yeah, so granddad came out first, and then nana came out on a 6-week trip, you know, to get here, which I kind of think is adventurous as well. Like she was only a young woman, and this was going to meet her fiance on the other side of the world. So Pākehā as well as Māori, and Christchurch, Timaru, I started school there because my dad was on an internship for radio. So he started at Radio Caroline. And then we lived in Blenheim for a bit, and he was on Radio Marlborough. And my dad's still on radio. His name's James Daniels, and he's on Newstalk ZB.
Yes.
To his own surprise, actually, to get offered another contract at, I think it was 66 years old. It was pretty cool.
Wow. Well, speaking of your dad, he is a broadcasting legend. Were you always going to be a broadcaster? Because was that your first kind of career chosen?
Not really.
Nah?
No. I was lucky enough to be around radio because of Dad. So people like Mike McRoberts were the young guys at my dad's work. And actually Steve Parr, if you remember him, and Simon Barnett.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, so they were all in at Dad's work. So they were kind of Dad's workmates more than...
No way.
I don't know if other kids think this, but I thought, oh, I'm not going to do that. It's just what Dad does, you know.
It's his thing.
Yep. Yeah, but funnily enough, what it did do is it removed a kind of barrier that I see some... particularly some Māori and Pacific rangatahi feel about getting into media, like they can't picture themselves in that setting.
Yes.
So I guess that removed that barrier for me. And then when I worked in What Now, it was all more not big long-term planning but taking opportunities as I saw them and what felt right, because I went to Japan as an exchange student, and then when I came back, I enrolled at the Uni of Canterbury, but in my heart I was thinking, I feel too unsettled after a year living away, learning another language. Everything had changed. My boyfriend of the time had moved away, from what I can remember, to Australia. And so I just went, I don't want to... Oh, no, he might have been Christ, I can't remember. But I don't want to settle into a uni schedule. I don't think this is the right thing for me. So I went, I have to get a job.
Yeah.
So in my mind, the only way I could justify not going to uni at that time was if I got a good job. So I went and hustled and asked for that. And TVNZ and had to move to Dunedin to work for TaylorMade Productions. That's why I did that, basically.
Yep.
Kind of to avoid uni, but in the nicest way.
You had an alternative. Like, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? I've got this.
And you have to do something. Like for me, it wasn't anyone else telling me that. I just thought for myself, if you're not going to uni, then you have to be doing something.
Cool.
And I guess I kind of, my son's year 13 now, and I can see that all those decisions playing out in him and his friends.
Yes.
And having somewhere to go is, I think, quite important in terms of feeling purposeful.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah, no matter what it is, and you'll be learning no matter what you're doing as long as you're engaged in something.
Yes. And what was your first role in broadcasting? How did you get that one?
Well, that one was because I'd already done some part-time work with What Now. And our producer of the time was Richard Driver, and he was the boss of What Now. I said, I'm back from Japan. Is there any work going? Yep. And he said, oh, yeah, okay, actually. We were talking about you because I'd had some experience. So once you're in broadcasting, we'd have to say it's easier because people know that you can do it.
They can see seen your work.
Yeah.
Oh, you've got experience.
Yeah, so that can be a barrier to people as well if you don't have that in.
Yeah.
So I did that, and then I was a reporter and kind of researcher for a show called From End to Z, which still went into What Now, but it was a segment, and we actually travelled from Cape Danga to Rakiura to the Stewart Island in the course of a year. So a really amazing job.
Yeah.
And we'd go on 10-day trips, and I'd help research, and then one of, you know, like we would go on a helicopter in Fiordland to talk about kind of science in a way that was relatable to kids. Yeah. So bungeeing being about, you know, kinetic energy. Mm. And so, yeah, really, oh my gosh, bless Ruapehu, all of these places I got to go to. And also I remember vividly for some reason that we got given per diems. Yeah. So you had an allowance for every day for your kai, and I would always save it and eat soup instead so that at the end of the week I still had lots of money and cash.
Nice.
I just remember it being hundreds, and then I'd drive back to Christchurch. Yeah.
Why did you do that? Is that something you learnt from someone? Or
no, I just went a little hoarder. It just made sense to me. Like I didn't need to spend all that money on food and drink, and then I'd have extra money as I saw it. Because it was cash, and I was actually, you know, pretty well paid for my age at that point. But I bought my own car, and I thought, and I still do that, I must admit, with per diems, you go, if I don't need a $50 meal, you know, I'll have the $20 one.
Yeah, sweet.
And then you still have your per diem, you know, like you might still need things on the road.
That's right.
But yeah, I guess that kind of is an indication of my money mindset, a little bit of, you know, I'd already experienced a bit of scarcity growing up.
Yep.
Did
you guys have a lot of money when you guys were growing up?
No. So my parents were teenagers when they had me. You know, it wasn't planned.
Yep.
And I was thinking about how do people get into houses in those days. I remember my parents saying that it was something about cashing in the DPB or the family benefit or something. You could do that and then use it as a deposit on your house, but that meant you wouldn't get any other.
Interesting. So you'd get benefits. It in a lump sum type payment. Oh, wow.
It's kind of amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. You get it all up front.
Yeah.
Wow.
But you've got to hope that you can then
use
look after your kids.
Yes.
I guess.
You can't go and spend it all.
But I just remember that, so Dad worked at a jewellery shop. I remember that. Māori Affairs. Mum went back to school as... like she had my sister at 19 and then went back to school at Hagley College.
Yeah,
and I remember her kind of having sort of jobs that would fit around us. And then when my parents broke up when I was 8, then their lives and their financial existences changed quite a lot and were quite separate different. But before I was 8, remember my dad doing an article once he became sort of well known on the radio about how the day that he got into broadcasting school, he had just exchanged some milk bottles so that he could get money for our tea, mints for the kids' tea.
Yeah,
and I
crazy.
Was like, Dad, why did you have to say that? It's so embarrassing. But it was real. I mean, that was another thing that.
Because you could get money. That's the milk bottles, right? You could get money for those bottles.
You wouldn't remember that, would you? Oh, you do.
Yep. That's that's how we got milk back then, right?
Yeah.
You just put those bottles out with the money on top, and the milk run guys would come through holding onto the back of the truck.
Yeah.
And you were the juice fingers. I was like, I want the juice.
Yeah.
But I'm definitely like,
no. The juice.
You can never get the juice.
Who are you kidding?
It's expensive, that juice.
Yeah. But it was yummy. I remember it was really yummy. And so I remember Dad saying that. I was like, this is, you know, embarrassing that you're just telling everyone how poor we were.
Yeah.
And then because Dad ended up doing well in broadcasting, he had money and he had different experiences as he built up, but we didn't live with him all the time. We lived with Mum.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And so she, like, I remember her working in a woodwork factory and, you know, lots of different jobs.
Yeah,
and then she became a sales rep, those kind of things. So I remember my parents' working life and their, I guess, a bit of a window into their stress.
Yeah.
Probably more than, say, my 11-year-old would be currently worried or concerned or even know what we do, really. Yeah.
Those, I suppose, financial challenges, How have they shaped your view on money today? Mm.
Well, first of all, I had to identify that they had shaped my thinking.
That's a good point.
And it's interesting that my sister, who's 2 years younger than me, she didn't perceive it the same as me. So when I got hand-me-downs or the neighbours giving us clothes, I found that really embarrassing, and I internalised it about money and worry and scarcity and there wasn't enough. And my sister says she thought, ha, this is cool. This used to be Elliot's, or, you know, like, this is funny.
True.
And she had a, that's her personality. And perhaps as the second child, but as the, you know, eldest, I'm, you know, worrying and, and trying to, not that an 8-year-old can actually do much about it, but I was obviously more of a worrisome kind of, a worried kind of kid. So I was very aware of that, and that my friend Jenna had a 2-story house. Mm. She's got a 2-story house.
2-story house. Imagine. That meant something, eh? 2 stories, money.
You are rich. And then Leanne had the nomads everyone wanted, and Kushla had the, like, the, you know, bickies from the actual shop, from the bakery. Like, dreamy.
Not so, the homemade ones.
Yeah, no. And I went to a school that is, you know, what do they call a low decile area, or socioeconomic areas, Aranui High School. So, yeah, a weird thing of people thinking I must be rich because my dad was on the radio, and then feeling like we didn't actually have that much. And Dad will say himself, I'm not being disrespectful to say he's always been pretty useless with money. So once he got it, he didn't really understand the value of it. And I remember him buying new clothes, and I was there with him in Cashel Mall, and he was trying them on. And I said, oh, my gosh, this is like $400. Mm. And he said at that point, when his career was just flying, he said, is that a lot? I went, and why did I know more? As a teenager, why did I know more about what money bought than he did? Yeah, so I guess, maybe eldest kids and maybe eldest daughters will relate to my mindset being very concerned with, like I say, with the per diems, you know, saving a bit, like just having something to fall back on. And also I realised I never expected anyone to, like my parents, to buy me anything. My first car, I never expected that they would help me.
Was it that, you know, that eldest thing, is that partly your responsibility? Do you feel like you have to take care of the siblings, especially if you can see, if you're your eyes are open to there being some difficulties with bills, or like, oh, hey, that doesn't feel like we are rich.
I think so. And as I say, I just mentioned my sister because I think her attitude is great, and it's her experience, and she's like, nah, it's all good, it's going to work out. And I think she's actually manifested that too. And not to say that I haven't, but, our, you know, our attitude towards it is different. So, yes, that sense of responsibility, if I try to explain what is different for us as Māori and Pacific, responsibility is part of the joy of our existence. And yet it is a challenge sometimes when you then look at your individual lot.
That's right.
So when you, your culture is based on collective, your considerations for what you as an individual should have, I think are impacted. Does that make sense to you?
Totally. Like, because I know I'm not the eldest, but I don't own all the money, but I, as a mortgage advisor, I understand financial services and products and how they can enable you to increase your wealth. And so I am seen, looked to, when it, hey, what should we do with this amount of money? What should, how should I handle my investments? So it's a great thing. It's this responsibility, but also a challenge to do it right, or do it to the best of your ability.
And do you find as well that when you seem to be responsible about money, then no one offers to help you?
Yes. It'll be fine.
Yeah, like, think about And you also don't need to give them a mihi. Don't say well done. Just go, nah, you're all good.
You should be doing well. You're good. But it's and it, part of that, it's that, you know, that kind of squeaky wheel gets fixed first type thing. And when you're good, it's the pro and con of being able to manage yourself.
Yeah.
Because, they should be fine, but everyone still needs encouragement and guidance, right, and kindness.
And I'm not saying they're being unkind, but it's just you just have roles in the family. And then both my parents remarried and then my dad married again. So I have siblings from, I think it's four marriages.
Yep.
And so, you know, like what, how we perceive ourselves. I just think birth order and roles and responsibilities in the whānau kind of play a part.
Yeah, big time. If we can go back to your career, what are some of your favourite shows that you've done?
always the last one or the next one, but National Treasures, which we do have a new series of coming out soon, is really special because it's one of those shows that is about people bringing in a keepsake or something that's important to them and how it relates to a part of New Zealand history. So as an example, a woman brought in the clothes that she was wearing on the day of the Christchurch earthquake and she was trapped inside a building. And these clothes are, apart from having a lot of dust on them still, they're grey and they're very office workerish. And this woman comes in bringing them and she's like dressed up like kind of, was that rockabilly kind of look? Yeah. She's got really beautiful hair and standout clothing and bright lips, and she's a statement. And she said that part of her story was when she was under that rubble, she thought about the parts of her life that she wasn't actually living and who she was as a person and what she wanted to wear and to be. And she went, if I get out of this alive, I'm going to be that person.
Wow.
And so those clothes became, yes, a story of the Christchurch earthquake, all of its tragedy and its hardship, but also how people can take that adversity and go, I'm going to change my life a little bit if I make it out. Yeah. So it's an incredible way to tell stories. And that's one of my favourites, but I love how people...
That's amazing.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
You just cry the whole blimmin' time doing these shows. But I think it's good for us to think about New Zealand history, recent history, because we haven't always been good at that. So that's why I love that show. But then, you know, my time seems... it's funny, with the fullness of time, I see that people, you know, it meant something to people, so that's really special.
You know what, my time? I had... know, playing sports on Saturday, there were two shows I had to watch on Saturday. It was X-Men the cartoon, Jordan's laugh, and then it was My Time. And I was like, those two, you know, sport, I'm going to be late today, guys.
That's so cute.
You know, I'm going to hit the second half running and we're going to win the game.
And if you were lucky, then you had a VHS and you could maybe... Tape it
for me. Yeah, no ads, please.
Yeah,
no
we haven't
ads.
Got any tapes left, so we can't. Or if someone tried to restart it after an ad and then they forgot. And my kids cannot relate because everything's on demand and they could have just watched any old time. So, those shows. And then I remember I did some funny ones like McDonald's Young Entertainers.
Yeah.
You know, people I met then, like the Alva'a family, met them at that time. And then, you know, you see them again. Sarah Jane I see a bit and Ono Sa'i I see a bit. You know, like I'm just really lucky, the sort of shows that I've done. And then... weird things. Like, I'm not a good person for having collectibles and knowing what I really did, but then I go, that's right, Celebrity Treasure Island. Random things.
Wicked, wicked. And you also chair the Spark Foundation.
Yep.
Can you tell me a bit about your work there and what inspires you to do that role?
I'd love to. So I've been on the Spark Foundation for 6 years and I became the chair last year our awesome chair, Andrew Pirie, left. So it's all about digital equity and we've refined that over the years to go, this is our real true focus, digital equity for rangatahi in New Zealand. And so it's about participation, representation, building access. And so we work with partners who are doing amazing mahi in communities and we work with them so that they can continue that mahi. You could say it's a funding relationship, but really it's a partnership. Because if we have these goals and values that we're trying to achieve towards digital equity, we need those partners in the communities and what they're doing in order to achieve it. So we're in partnership with them. And ideally for... 2 or 3 years at least, because we recognise that it's hard for organisations to continually be looking for money yearly. Yes. That's not productive for them. So I guess one of the things I'm really proud of is that we looked at how the application process was working and not working for people and tried to make it better so that people could come in. Like one I think about, they came in and they said, oh, we just thought we were just going to get a trip to Auckland. There's no way we'd get this. And they did a oral presentation and they showed us some pictures and they went, jokes, you'll never give us this. And I didn't even have to do a speech. I didn't have to get anyone on board. My board just went, wow, this is so cool. And, you know, your community is getting engaged and getting access and opportunities they never had before, and we'd love to support you. And just seeing the look on their faces, I just felt proud because it wasn't me, it was them.
Yeah.
But as a Māori representative, I went, oh, look at you blowing these people away. And that's been a really amazing
Wicked.
Partnership.
Wicked. Yeah. That's cool. And in terms of Māori and Pacifica, you know, digital equity, what are the numbers, and is that getting better?
In terms of working in tech, no, it's still something like 4%.
Yeah.
So Te Hapori Matsihiko is one of the kaupapa that we work with, and so that's about building digital community. And also we work with Fibre Whale.
Yes.
So both of them are looking at, like, it's not just about access, or it's not just about getting a device. It's also about, you know, well-being, yes, but equity means that we actually need to be in these working spaces and have leadership who are Māori and Pacific as well, not just, you've got some data. That's not equity.
True.
So it's participation and growth in every level, also ensuring cultural integrity and I guess in terms of intellectual property and cultural intellectual property, those are the things that Māori and Pacific need to have agency in, or else it can, you know, they just chuck a moko on a digital avatar and it's around the world, they go, isn't this cool? Lucky you guys, we like your stuff.
Yes.
And there's no integrity. And also when we know the responsibilities and sometimes even the tapu that lay in mahi toi and artwork and in the carriers of that work, it was different when it was only ever, you know, in person, on a person, in a piece of art. And now in the digital world, it can go everywhere.
Yes.
So how do we express mana motuhake and that kind of an arena that has no bounds in some ways.
Yeah. Awesome. Let's talk to Reo. You're a massive advocate, teacher of Te Reo Māori. Were you always fluent?
No. It's funny, I heard someone said to me, they were saying how you and Scotty aren't even native speakers. I'm like, yeah, no shit, Sherlock. That's literally our whole shtick. Is that we...
That's our thing.
Yeah. So, and if you're like us, then, you know, this is what we've experienced and we know it's hard, and we're here to encourage people to engage with the deal, even if it hasn't been part of your life. So for both of us, we had to learn later. I was probably in my 20s.
Really? Wow.
And he just went to university after doing second year, seventh, I'm going to say, because he just wanted to play more sport. And turned up at uni and ended up finding, you know, unlocking through incredible tutors this love and ultimately, I think, destiny with Te Reo Māori. But it's hard. And as, you know, when you are kind of locked out of your language and therefore feel locked out of your culture, there's just so many emotional, spiritual, intellectual aspects to that reclamation. So that's why the work is endless. and a real privilege.
What kind of lit the fire or began the journey for you into learning?
I was hoping to avoid it because it's impossible to not feel stupid and lacking.
Yep.
When you're a learner, you can't turn up and just go, wow, I just happen to be amazing at this the next day. And if you're a perfectionist, it's hard.
Yeah.
And I'd been good at English at school, but this was different. And even in learning Japanese, no one thought that I should be able to speak Japanese, so I just found this freedom of, just give it a go.
Yeah.
Not like that with Māori, really laden with and fraught with whakamā, with, you know, with embarrassment and frustration.
Yeah.
Because I felt like I could kind of hear this murmur of my language inside me, you know, and how my body would react to hearing haka and waiata, knowing that's part of me, but then not being able to get my tongue to say it. So in terms of lighting a fire, it was more like once the fire became so unavoidable, that's when I really had to. And part of it was getting a job on Marae and working with people who are fluent speakers, and then having to kind of do stories. Like, the only story that I could really do that had integrity was going, I have to learn about my whakapapa. I literally have to go home. I have to go through this process that ideally would have been my birthright.
Yeah, wow. So a whole journey of self-discovery in a way, identity.
Yeah, and also unravelling and unpacking what was just taught to us as unquestionable.
Yes.
Like James Cook discovered New Zealand.
Mm.
And, like, even the teacher who was teaching us that, why was there nothing in their head that went, but really, if I am a history teacher, this is illogical. We know there were already people here.
Yeah.
So how could we use the word discover? You know, but what that does is it tells us who's most important. And the importance is placed on the English captain who first saw this land, not the Māori inhabitants who were already here for like hundreds of years.
They were first.
Yeah, they were first, but these guys matter. That's really what it says.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that unpacking.
Yeah.
And when you realise that your education, just going, this is what it is.
Yes.
And Māori came on Seven Waka, and even that's, you know, incorrect. You know, we know. All of that kind of valuing and devaluing of types of knowledge and forms of knowledge and whose history kind of matters and is seen as higher in terms of cultural value.
Yes.
Yeah, that's all part of the journey. So that's why it's endlessly fascinating. And
yeah, big time.
And I also ended up feeling like in my job, if I was going to be taking positions like this, I had, again, a responsibility to learn the reo, because it just would be rude to be taking in a Māori role and not taking the opportunity to also upskill myself. Because in seeing me learn, I realised that other people went, oh my gosh, I used to be a kia ora girl as well. Like, all I could say was kia ora, and I've seen you learn, so it must be possible. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. The barriers to learning to them have been around for a long time, haven't they? Because when your dad was growing up, it was suppressed.
Yeah.
It was, I remember, you know, at primary school, it's like, hey, you know, what's that? It wasn't even welcomed or a thing. What do you think has changed from that your dad's generation to now, and it's been more welcoming?
Well, I guess, it's even about who gets to do the welcome. Who gets to do the welcoming?
True.
Yeah. I'd say it's more truthful. It's good to be truthful about why the language is in such a precarious state, why Te Reo Māori is an official language of New Zealand, and in its official status, it was needed for protection. it was needed so that investment from the government could be justified.
Yeah.
So it's not, yeah, it actually, so when we say things like, I was just looking at Peter P. Walker's really good kōrero about how when a directive came out to name our agencies, say Waka Kotahi now should be New Zealand Transport Agency and then Waka Kotahi, it's actually not law. And it's, he was saying, it's actually unlawful because as an official language, that gives Māori, te reo Māori, the status that it can be used in every government forum, public forum, in courts. That's part of what the official status is. But because it was 1987, and I guess people just didn't look at that as being something that everyone needed to understand, the status of the language is always a big part of its revitalization. So status is the part that we see in the education system and in government agencies, because that's when we say, okay, te reo Māori has value here. Then you get into the mechanics of learning the language and then of the corpus and then so what language do you need, who can you talk to, and these are all elements of language revitalization that we have to work on.
Wicked.
I'll drink more water.
Yeah, go for it. What would you say to someone who is wanting to learn more, who is Māori, wanting to learn more and speak more, but there is that kind of embarrassment and fear and somewhat, you know, ashamed of looking or getting it wrong, I suppose. Yeah, what would you say to them? What advice would you give them?
Kia kaha koe, like, don't give up, because the cost of giving up is a lot. There's a lot of regret, and it's awful because we didn't choose this situation. But the power is in choosing what we do now. And that we're going to have to, unfortunately, work hard for it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we tend to value things that we work hard for. So there's, I guess, the celebration. I guess I want to say I'm sorry that it's so hard. And what we can do is make it better for our kids. And intergenerational transmission is intergenerational healing. So say, like, with some Pacific languages, from what I know with my friends, that's the language of their home.
Yes.
So they have their Pacific and home language. But perhaps then might feel like when they go to Samoa or Tonga, they go, everyone's laughing at me. My language isn't as good as their language. So we all have our different cultural traumas about it. But then if we go, particularly for the next generation, what if they have nothing? And what if they come to us and they say, why didn't you teach me? Like, I've never asked my dad that, because I know why, and I see his own pain at that. And I see that he's now turned, he's 69 now, and he tells me every week, like he forgets he's already told me, that he loves taking my nephew to Kurukaupapa.
Wicked.
He takes him every day.
That's epic.
And ka kōrero Māori, and he loves the fact that my nephew is kind of showing him and helping him learn the reo in some ways. But, you know, I feel for my dad, because his mum was a native speaker, and so he's really the generation that just went, I don't think I can do it. But I think that his moko is one of the ones. You know, even though my kids have been on that, I mean, my son's 17, it's been around him, but in some of his youngest moko, he sees, you know, I guess an opportunity to go, oh, he's at kind of my level, so I can kind of, you know, kōrero Māori. Yeah. You can always restart.
Yeah, cool. I'd seen in one video you referred to Scotty, your husband, as the Māori dictionary.
Yeah. Quite freakish.
How helpful has he been in your journey? Or did you guys learn together?
No. He was already a fluent speaker. I remember saying in... Hang on, sorry. That's a good blooming cough.
Take your time.
Ear. remember saying in the Nuku podcast that I wanted to recognise my privilege of my husband being a fluent speaker. That's made it endlessly easier. And people have said to me, well, you're all good because you married the Māori Dictionary. And yes, that's true. It's about the dynamic of our relationship too, you know.
Yeah, totally.
That he's totally kind with it. He never went, you know, made me feel stupid.
Yep.
He was much better than me when we got together, and he still is now in lots of ways. I think what I've heard him say to other people especially is that he respects my effort and that I never gave up. And we had a vision for our tamariki to be first language Māori speakers. And
that's epic.
That's
really cool.
And he hadn't been in a relationship with another fluent speaker. So for us, it's new ground we've built together. And, you know, to have, like, you know, if you're arguing in te reo Māori, you're really fluent.
True. Yeah. I can tell. I know when I'm getting told off by my mum. My mates don't understand, but I know.
Yes. And there's tone and there's all those things that you can actually use to help you learn language. But, yeah, no, mai kore ake taku tāne, you know, basically without him, I'm not sitting here. That's what I think. But I guess one thing that I'm grateful for, and in particular, is the mutual respect we have for each other, because we made this decision that this would be the language of our home and for our tamariki. It was hard. Now, blooming kids, none of them were sleepers. None of them were good sleepers. So I'd be exhausted and then trying to find any language, let alone my second language, and stay in the language exclusively with the kids. And I think we both respect each other, and I forgot that I could have given up.
Mm.
It just wasn't even an option. And I think if I had given up, it would have impacted us as a couple. Yeah, it would have been a disappointment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I would have felt like a disappointment. Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, not awesome.
Like, awesome that you didn't give up. Right? You rose to that challenge, I suppose. Because it's not, like, I find it difficult. My wife is Marangi Pākehā, and I find it difficult to speak to my tamariki in Samoa, because I'm not, you know, it is a challenge when I'm not in Samoa.
Yeah.
I'm not in the environment. But when I'm in it, it just flows back. Yeah.
All of those intricacies of relationship are really interesting, and we don't maybe talk about a lot. A friend of mine felt really upset that their initial vision was to always have Māori in the home, and the language that her husband spoke would be the language he spoke to the kids in. And then they got to a certain age, and she was devastated. She said, I think it's costing our relationship. And if our relationship isn't awesome, then nothing's going to be awesome for the kids.
That's right.
So she said, but then I have to let go of what I thought it was going to look like.
Yeah.
And I said to her, your kids are amazing. He tamariki karakia, like, they can do karakia.
Yeah,
they love the language. They are also fluent in their father's language. And so there is no way you have failed in any way. It might not look like what you thought it was going to, but you just have to find comfort in what it looks like now. Because you can see the cost. The cost would be of the relationship that ensures you're happy as a whānau, so that's not worth it.
Mm.
So I do think partially, as much as I laugh and say people go, oh, you just married the Māori Dictionary, part of it is for them to go, see, I can't do that because I don't have that.
Yeah.
And that's why I want to say, yep, for sure. A lot of barriers have been removed for me because I have married a fluent speaker, because we both have jobs, because we have some financial security, because we're not stressed about feeding our children every day. That gives me freedom to learn, gives me more headspace to find the words that I need, even if I was struggling. And I established that relationship with my children in this language, so that is most natural for both of us. If I was saying at a Ngāi Tahu conference on the reo the other day, if we don't make a deliberate decision to speak Te Reo Māori in the home, the default decision will be to speak English.
That's so true.
Because that's easiest.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's no shame in that. You don't have to be just, like, there's not just one way of doing it. Like, you don't have to be as intense as we've been about it.
Yep.
Every part along that spectrum, anyone who's making an effort is still winning.
True.
It's just
so
you don't have to go, well, I'm not that, so I might as well do nothing.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have to be, I suppose, defeatist in a way.
Yeah.
But, oh, I can't do this, I'll just do nothing. Oh, I can't even get that. Oh, I won't do that.
Yeah.
We're all growing at different rates because we are different people.
Yeah. It's like at the gym, you know, like you could go, well, I'm not going to be the rock, so there's no point.
Yeah.
But you know that you're better than you were yesterday. Yes. You know that your mood's better. You know that you've got a sense of accomplishment.
Yeah.
You know that you feel better, literally.
Yeah.
So that makes it worthwhile. It's not all just to be the best. And
you're right.
Judging each other, like with the Polyfest, which is fantastic, that's just been on here. It's huge in Tāmaki Makaurau. And the expression of our cultures, and it's, you know, right across the Pacific, is so important. And then sometimes when we get too much into the competition and judging aspect, I feel a little bit uncomfortable.
Mm.
And it's not sour grapes because my daughter's kappa one, but it's more like, awesome. Yes, and what is most important is that our kids can express themselves in their cultures and that they can uphold tikanga and they have confidence, and you can just see how they're holding themselves and they know they're great.
Wicked.
Yeah, that's what I love.
Speaking Te Reo, or Samoan or Tongan, you know, knowing and understanding the language, I see as a gateway to the culture. Mm. Sorry, another half of my
questions gateway to the culture. So,
so what are the other in Māori? What are the other benefits of learning the language?
Well, I guess if I stay with that analogy with the gym, you feel better, you feel a sense of achievement, you know you've put some mahi in, so there's partially that. But also it's just the dawning of understanding is really satisfying when you sort of go, oh, man, I know what they said. And quite often you'll go, I understood what they said, but I don't know how to make that sentence myself. Like, that's a stage in learning. And I remember sort of being happy but sort of being frustrated. I was like, oh, I knew every word in that sentence, but I just didn't know to put it together like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess it's the energising factor of always learning.
Yeah, wicked.
I think that's one of it. And also just being in on the jokes. I used to try to laugh at the right time when I was around Māori speakers, and I didn't really understand what they're laughing at, but I'd try to sort of anticipate and go, like, I don't really understand what you said. feeling that, honestly, sometimes I just feel like I can just feel our tupuna smiling, but also knowing that you're speaking what they spoke.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, and especially with, say, karakia and the spiritual elements, it's just a really deep connection and comfort.
Mm.
Yeah, and just not feeling alone, I think.
Awesome.
Yeah, that for me, I just feel this real sense of a gathering and an endlessness and a continuum that we are part of.
Yeah, wow.
And that's beautiful.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying that's not yours if you're not a Reo speaker.
Yeah.
But I'm saying even if you don't understand the words, you can still feel it.
Wicked.
Yeah.
And what in, you've kind of touched on a lot of it, what inspires you to do this mahi? You know, you've got the book here. It's not the only book.
No.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, books and TV shows, what inspires me.
And you've got a podcast as well.
Yeah. It's because this is what I can do.
Mm.
Yeah. I guess I've just sort of seen where I, at my age, stage and experience, one more time.
Yeah, go for it.
That's a funny little dog.
Pantera.
Yeah. Someone's office dog, is it?
It is.
Oh, yeah. I guess I just can see at my age, stage and experience that I can help bridge particularly, I guess, people who are not on the waka or not quite sure how to get on it or not quite sure how to engage with Te Reo Māori, offer them a way in. Like when you were talking about how the schooling system might be more welcoming to us, well, I guess the welcome kind of has to be both ways. And people need an access point or a bridge sometimes. Because I'm Pākehā and Māori, so, you know, I try not to make an echo chamber of people who agree with me. And sometimes it's really hard and I listen to, like, people who say, well, this is all just too woke to have te reo Māori on things. I think it's kind of hilarious because I'm pretty sure the first time I heard about woke and conscious is like in black hip hop. They really stole their word, you know, for one thing. And so if you're woke, you're conscious. It's not even a bad thing.
Nah.
It's hilarious. And it's just the latest in a pattern of how to undermine te reo Māori. Used to be at school, well, that Māori won't get your job.
True.
Japanese will. And I learned Japanese, so I'm not, like, just saying this as a theory. I did learn Japanese, not a great speaker, but a conversational speaker. And so I know, if you want to, yes, sure, fantastic. And I actually love learning every language. But it's the commodity and value of a language is not just on what job you can get. Yeah. Ends up now that you can get a lot of jobs because of te reo Māori. And then, again, when I talk about that gap in my generation, there's a lot of people from my generation who went, okay, I'll do what you tell me to. I'll just be really good at English, and I'll do economics, and I'll be an accountant, and I'll be a lawyer, and then that's how I'll be a good Māori. And then they turn around and find out, well, wait, now you are saying, can you do the karakia? And you don't know how to do it, and now I have to feel bad about that. Yeah. Like, how do those people feel like they win? You go, I did what you told me to do to be a valuable contributor. And in some ways, you see the forfeit of effort for learning and regaining our language. So, yeah. He wāhanga tō te reo Māori ki te whakakotahi a tātou. You know, the language can actually bring us together because it is the language of this land. And because it actually, more and more, we're understanding our ties with each other as Polynesians. Yes. It's a big part of the mahi that my husband's done with his show Origins, you know, to look at how we are all connected and what we can hear in our languages connect us. And also to go, okay, we actually have to humble ourselves every time we learn something new. And in that humility, we're in a learning and listening phase rather than a lecturing and deciding we already know that our take on this is set and I won't be moved from that, you know. So, pingore, like being flexible and open, I think is a better place for us to be in,
Cool, let's jump into personal finances. We kind of talked a little bit about that before. Did you guys talk about money growing up?
Probably not in positive ways.
Yeah.
Just if there was enough or not enough or can't have that or that kind of stuff. And then I will say that as I got older, like both my parents had different experiences and more comfortable experiences with money usually. But then also my dad has been bankrupt and he's open about talking about that. And so, yeah, I think that's why I was thinking about what I've tried to do for myself. And I was reminded when Māori Millionaire went and met Robert Kiyosaki recently.
Yeah, I remember
poor dad as well.
Yeah.
And one of the things that really stood out from that was going, you don't have to live in your flash house now. And actually it's better for you not to and then be having investments on the side. And I thought, oh, that's so interesting. Because, you know, our way of looking at success in New Zealand tends to be about houses and what your house is like and all that kind of stuff.
Two-story house.
Yeah. Well, Dina Mackay did have a two-story house, and that really stuck in my mind. But, yeah, I guess growing up, to answer your question, money was talked about in a stressed kind of way. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you consider yourself good with money now?
Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What kind of processes, like, throughout life, or have you gotten some financial advice that have kind of shaped your understanding or how good you feel about money now?
Yeah, well, I've had some bad experiences and I've had some good experiences.
Yeah.
I'm a natural saver, I realised. Yes. That's kind of my response to having had scarcity, is to save so that I can look and go, it's okay. So my husband calls me Captain Sensible when it comes to money. He is not the same captain. He's captain to the sky.
He's another captain. Captain
He's
Kirk.
On a different plane. And so because of that, I actually signed us up for Enable Me. And this is not sponsored, but I love Hannah McQueen.
She is coming on.
Oh, how good. Ooh. Yeah. Well, feel free to talk to her about that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That was partially because I really like what she said about financial personal training. I could relate to that. And that she talked about money personality.
Yes.
And my husband and I have quite different money personalities. Yeah. And again, I'll just say, I'm the eldest, he's the youngest. I feel like those two things are
they've wheedled their way through and it has an effect.
Yeah, the youngest is like, it's all good, don't worry. But if it wasn't for that, I'd just sit there saving money and go, precious. And as an example, I heard him saying to someone, because we're getting a pool. And when they left, I said, I thought we were still talking about that. He goes, no, I've signed the contract.
We did talk. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And he said, and wasn't it a great decision? I go, yes, it was.
Yeah.
It was. It's made the kids, you know, like, interact with the house differently, bring people home. Yeah, we've actually spent hours at home that we might spend somewhere else, you know, spending money. He's managed to on-sell, like, about four pools to other people he knows because he's just such a champion influencer in that way. But... you know, there's also no point in just saving money and saving and
That's
never
right.
getting to enjoy it. So anyway, we go to Hannah.
Cool.
And what I really liked about her is she went, okay, so first of all, yes, a goal. To me, an absolutely audacious goal of getting rid of your mortgage, paying off your mortgage. Like, that blows my mind and any perception of possibility that I had.
Yeah.
So how is that even possible? And then she says, and you should do it in 6 years. I'm like, 6 years? Not, listen to my voice, not 25 years, not 30 years. And then sets how you're going to do it.
Wow.
And then we discover this part of my husband's personality, which is also like, give me a goal and I'm there. So if he has a goal and he can see something.
Set a challenge.
Yeah. It's like, so he is a black belt in karate. He's a brown belt or something in jiu-jitsu.
Oh.
So goals and stepping and just like how he has with the deal, he gets that. So you put that on top of finances and all of a sudden Captain to the Sky goes step, step, step.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going up. You know, I've got a goal. I see it. So that's when he really got on board. But what I like with Hannah as well, she went, okay, here's your budget. And she looked at me and she goes, so that's how much you spend on clothes? I went, yeah. And she said, I don't think you're being honest. I went, okay. She said, I think we need to put another $100 on that. I went, okay. So she was just on. She went, okay, literally check yourself before you wreck yourself, because if you set a budget that's, you know, setting you up for failure and you are not going to stick to it, then there's actually no point. But just know that if you do spend that much more on clothes or whatever is your thing, then, you know, you're not going to have money at this end, right?
Yep, true. Mm. What made you go to Hannah McQueen or seek her out or find her? Because a lot of people sat there and like, what do I do? I'm just going to ask. Most people get advice from their family. And whether it be good or bad, that's the advice they get. But what made you guys?
Oh, because I'd had bad advice from my family. You've got to learn, man. You've got to learn.
The old financial advisor at home didn't work.
Yeah, yeah, no. Well, did I mention my dad was bankrupt? But anyway, so that I ended up losing a lot of money in my 20s. I was working three jobs and saving a lot. And crushingly, at the time I went, $280,000 for a house? That's ridiculous. No way I'd do that. I should have done that. Instead, I supported a family investment and everything went really badly. So I lost a lot of money. So I guess my husband can call me Captain Sensible, but I know what happens when it goes wrong.
Yep.
And I've, you know, would be a lot better off if that hadn't happened. But I guess what made me turn to Hannah was because I could see that we had an incompatibility, and rather than me nagging him and our relationship being like, I don't, you know, we don't agree with each other on money stuff, let's have someone lift up. And it's not to say I'm right and he's wrong, because that's not right either.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like let's lift our vision up and have someone who actually knows what they're talking about and then can actually explain it to both of us, go, this is what I see as a potential for you. As I say, paying off a mortgage did not even enter my mind. So if someone sees a higher potential for you, then I think that's worth paying for.
Yeah, totally.
Also on a relationship level, to not be like working against each other, but we've got a common goal, and so we both know what we're trying to do.
Yeah, you're working as a team now, and you've got a coach there going, this is where we're heading.
Yeah, cool. And also just when you start to think about financial personality, it's so interesting because, yes, I like buying clothes, but I'll always know how much I spent on them, often wait for them to be on sale, get one that looks similar that's cheaper. My husband will go, nah, buy the best one, the most expensive one, and then you won't need to buy another one.
Yeah, because there's value in both reasoning, right?
Yeah.
Because quality should last longer.
Yeah, but then he also wears clothes that got holes in them, so.
Maybe he's so good, he's had it for so long, it's starting to wear
out. He loves it, and he says it's good. It just goes to show when he likes something, he sticks with it, so this is good for me too. A friend of ours came to our house a few years ago, and I love how candid this is of him, and he said, I was talking to another mutual friend, and I said, I'm at your place, and they said, oh, what, do they have a mansion? He goes, nah, like it's an, I mean, I'm not, don't get me wrong, this is a nice house, but it's not a mansion. And he said, really? I thought they'd have a mansion. It's like, how much money do you think people get paid in media? Like, we're not all, you know, you know, these big wages that you hear about in TV and Z, especially not for Māori programs, to be fair. And so I thought it was funny that our friend was basically giving us a kind of backwards compliment saying, so-and-so thought you'd have a mansion. And I said, no, it's not a mansion.
And it's a nice They're all good. It's not a mansion. I'm okay with that. You're okay.
To go back to the rich dad, poor dad thing, if you have a mansion, you have a massive mortgage, more likely. And that this is Auckland. You know, it's not a mansion and it's still going to cost a ridiculous amount of money.
I've seen those memes where, you know, growing up, this is what I thought $1 million house looked like. This is what actually, and it's nowhere near, it's not that big mansion that I thought it was going
to be. Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's funny and it's grounding. And we could, you know, I remember someone saying to me they had a really flash house. And she was quite famous at the time on TV. And she was, at that stage, people were really obsessed with talking about people on TV and what they owned and their houses. And so that would be in the newspaper, as it was. And she said, it really annoys me because they don't know how big my mortgage is. And they're just saying, she has this flash house on this street, and they don't know the whole story. So I think it's a, I will say it's a big city danger as well, to go, you know, big flash house. And then I look at the houses in Christchurch, I can't. I cannot with those mansions in the middle of town, Pendleton and around Boys
Mirabelle,
High. You are freaking me out. That's a whole suburb and it's a house. Like this house is going for houses and houses.
It's, yeah, yeah. You're like, oh, there's the mailbox, and you keep driving. Still at the same house.
Yeah, and then just to cause myself pain, I look up how much they're worth compared to an Auckland house.
Yeah.
That is, yeah, I thought it was going to be a mansion, but it's not a mansion. And, yeah, if I live back home, you could just get so much more. Yes. So I guess for me it's so interesting the things that we are maybe thinking about each other,
yep,
and judging, and this is why I feel safe in this place to say,
yeah,
okay, this was our goal, we
cool
got help,
yep,
and we achieved it because I want that for more of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, part of me, you know, asking these types of questions to guests that come on is about inspiring hope.
Mm.
Because when I look at some of my customers that come in and they go, I can't buy a house, I'm like, hey, and then I share a story of people who are in the same situation. I was like, you can, and this is the pathway. And then it's the hope inside them that kind of switches on like a light. And I go, yeah, but and this is the pathway. We can just do these things and you'll have enough deposit. You've got great income. You don't have to earn hundreds of thousands to get a home,
yeah,
but you just need to be good with your money. And so I thank you for being honest and vulnerable. That's the whole goal of this podcast, is to get people talking about it.
Yeah.
Good, bad, in between.
Yeah.
Like, I think people need to hear these stories.
I think the other thing is that so it's kind of like, koe whakahihi, like, don't be full of yourself.
Yes.
And it's
yes
not that. And again, I want to reiterate that in the context of losing a lot of money.
Yeah.
I lost a lot of money that I earned while working three jobs,
yep,
from, you know, every night 7 till 9:30.
Yeah.
You know, every day 7 till 9:30 kind of thing. So I lost a lot. And then and as I say, we also, there's always factors like we bought at the right time. The market wasn't as crazy as it is now, and we got help. We got someone to say, try harder, aim higher.
Cool.
Yeah, so that's the thing as well. And it's so interesting to me as well. When we feel guilt or whakamā, it's about what do we think we deserve, and also, can you still be a nice person if you're your idea of rich? Because I definitely had this idea that rich people are not very nice.
Yes.
Yeah.
I just want to touch on this term, elite Māori. You know, what is that? And is, or like, from my understanding, is it a form of tall poppy syndrome? Yeah. Is that what it can be kind of compared to, or is it something else?
I don't know either, because I'm not a person who's going to say it.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I do know that, okay, so this is what I've pieced together.
Yeah.
That when they say elite Māori, there's a suggestion that there's some Māori who have benefited in a way that is not fair, or that they're elite and therefore not connected with the rest of their people, you know? Or don't do anything for their people. And also a suggestion of getting something easier. Which is funny to me, because when we talk about, you know, just so casually in media commentary, the bank of mum and dad, it's like, what bank are you talking about?
Yeah. I'm like, I don't know where that is. Is that next to BNZ or?
Exactly. And so for many of us, that jokes, we might pay back.
Yeah.
Mum and dad, or yes, mum or dad. So these terms are designed, you know, to sort of tell us what's normal in society. And also with the elite Māori thing, I know it's sometimes related to post-settlement iwi, like Ngāi Tahu, where I'm from as well. To sort of go, oh, look, they got all this money, which, by the way, 180 million is not a lot of money.
No.
As redress for basically most of the South Island. And then going, a suggestion that it never gets back to the people, but it does.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know that,
yeah,
because I experience it in terms of my iwi supporting my reo learning journey,
yeah,
supporting my children in their ngaitahutanga and being ngaitahu in the ways that we can save money for and with the kids or for ourselves with whairawa, how we have opportunities to, you know, get into homes. So if that's elite, they need to understand, say, for instance, you know, almost 2 years in court to get that settlement through. And then years and years of people mortgaging their houses so that the iwi could actually put the claim in. And then apart from that, losing, say, in one sweeping, incredibly wrong deal like the Kemp purchase, you can just lose almost everything.
Yeah.
So I guess it's where you put your attention. You'd have to put a laser little beam on one person to decide who's elite or not. But it's... I don't have a problem owning what privileges I have.
Mm.
And I find that really interesting that some people do.
Yeah.
So one of the privileges is if the bank of mum and dad even makes sense to you, if you have inherited anything, you are privileged in New Zealand. Yeah.
Interesting.
So I'm willing to say we're unprivileged. I'm privileged to have my own language. I'm privileged to now be middle class.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with that, but it does not disconnect me from my people. It does not mean I don't care about my people. They also don't know about koha. They don't know about who else I might support or have supported and my own understanding of a tax system that I feel is right. Like if I do a government contract, like one I've done, I thought I need part of this to go somewhere where it's not going to go otherwise, and so I made sure that that happened.
Yeah.
You know, so we all have our own ways of enacting our responsibilities to our people.
Yeah, yeah. Wicked. In Samoa.
Sorry, and just quickly, only I guess a comment like that means that Māori are being judged on what we do with our money in ways that other people aren't.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, true. In Samoan culture, we have this thing called the whaalavelave, which is, you know, it could be a funeral, it could be a celebration, like a wedding, and it's this beautiful thing where we come together and we pull our resources to show care and assist a family in need or a family in celebration. Is there a, well, essentially we give money to that family. Is there a similar thing in Māori?
Yeah, that's what koha.
Oh,
usually
okay,
are.
Okay, okay.
So, you know, when you say, so let's say tangihanga is a funerals as a context.
Yes.
So when you go on, every time that there's a group that goes on, everyone, they'll send an envelope around and everyone puts money in, and that gets put down usually by the last speaker. And so that will be full of money that everyone's brought in, and that's offered to the family so that that helps support them putting on the tangi.
Yeah, wow.
And it's circular because it will be noted. Usually one of the whānau now will note who's given what. And at a time of need for that whānau, they will return it. So koha is a natural circular economy.
Yes. Yeah,
it's
yeah,
not
true.
Just you're just giving.
Yep.
It's usually reciprocated in some way. And whether they can give you money or whether they can then cook in the kitchen when your whānau is in grief, it comes back. Yeah.
Man,
so,
man.
Yeah, but it's really interesting to me, like, all those expectations of offering money. I mean, now things are, like, on tangi notices, quite often they'll have a bank account if people want to give koha.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's good because we've realised now we can't always be there.
Yes.
But we sort of have ways of talking about it. We go, hei tēnā te aroha noa. This is small, but it's sent with love, and it's our way of showing regard.
Yeah.
And there might be flowers as well, but yeah, it's kind of a way of supporting families going, this is an extra stress you don't need at this time. Yeah.
Yeah,
so there's that, and there's, I mean, there's so many interesting aspects of Māori economy around shared ownership of land and how that can be wonderful, but it's not a straight inheritance usually. It's like how many of us, if you've only got six people who own that piece of land, you're sweet. It's not 27 or 100 or 1,000. Yeah. Yeah.
Wicked. What are your hopes and dreams for Māori and your work you're doing there?
for us to have cultural wealth and to be thriving in every way. But that's actually us being our best selves as New Zealanders, I think. So I have so much hope and admiration for the generations coming through now. And I think in a lot of ways we've just got to get to where they are more in the decision-making roles and everything will be quite a lot better.
Let's get them up there.
Yeah. But also, you know, agency in every way, it's kind of tino ranga tiratanga, self-determination lots of different ways. So and it's really important that we know, and being distinct and being your true authentic self, that doesn't mean that you can't interact with someone who's different from you and respect their ways. For us to thrive really in all the ways there are to thrive.
And a final question, what does wealth mean to you? Like there's kind of riches, which is kind of money, and wealth to Pacifica point of view is involves obviously well-being and that kind of thing as well. It's this kind of holistic view. What does it mean to you?
I think wealth is being able to enjoy your mokopuna and your tamariki and to be happy. What is the point in having financial riches if you're not happy? And with the people that you know, who are most important to you. So health is wealth, for one thing. I'm the eldest female in my mother's line for 3 years, for three generations, the direct line to me. So getting to be old is wealth, you know, getting to be older. It's whatever it means to you. So I'd say let's not define success or wealth by anybody else's standards except for our own, and it will look different for all of us.
Wicked. Well, Stacey, thank you so much for coming on Fresh Money. Appreciate your time, and I wish you, Scotty, and your tamariki all the best for the future.
Tēnā rā, Hatsukui. Thank you so much.